minutes. If you turn to the next page, you'll see this graph. We have Bill works for the Intelligent Transportation Department and works closely with John Mackler and Portland Institute of Transportation. We're able to get good data. This show just shows in graphic terms the impact on traffic volume before and after the crash. In terms of what this crash meant, on this page it shows you that a normal day, that travel time, the economic cost of normal congestion, and this is a congested part of the region, it costs, has an economic cost of $180,000. Again, sort of apples to apples with that $844 million annual cost of congestion from the PBA study. On June 2nd, the cost of congestion nearly doubled, and the difference is to the economy was $150,000. You turn to the next page, for every 10 minutes in my city, and it would be slightly different in cities around Oregon, but it's a cost in every city. For every 10 minutes of delay, that's an economic impact of $20,000. And then it grows exponentially. So every 20 minutes of delay, it's $50,000. And the interesting thing is, this is probably something that you're already familiar with, but the cost of crashes add up. 50% of congestion is non-reoccurring. I think that's true statewide as it is for the Portland area. 25% of that non-reoccurring delay is as a result of crashes. The other 25% is weather and construction. And the conclusion, of course, is that we can reduce the cost of congestion onto our economy without spending a single penny on construction. We can also save lives and injuries. 250 incidents per month in the Portland area in terms of numbers are non-injury, and they're the easiest to address, and that's what these bills focus on. We recently, recognizing, although I am the transportation commissioner from Portland, and you would think that I would have all the tools necessary to get the job done in the city of Portland, the fact of the matter is there are over 20, 25 transportation providers in my jurisdiction. And recognizing that fact, earlier this year, we have now started something called POST, which is the Portland Operations Steering Team. For transportation, so we're all now working on this together. This is one of the first products out of the POST meeting that includes ODOT and TriMet. The county owns a lot of the bridges in my jurisdiction. It includes all those, and we're trying to come up with, starting with the easiest solutions first. So Senate Bill 567 on the handout deals with the fact that we have about 25 crash collisions per year in the Portland area involving parked cars on the freeway. We just recently had one in eastern Portland where a milk truck hit an individual who was taking a nap in his car on the side of the street, and we have been able to map the economic cost of that particular crash, but it went longer than the crash you have mapped before you. All of those avoidable crashes are what we're talking about here. And right now, as Bill will tell you in greater details, ODOT is limited in the times that it can remove those stalled or abandoned or parked cars on the freeway. SB 567 would address that. SB 566, the Move It, addresses the misperception out there and I think provides comfort to individuals like those two that were sitting on their hood on June 12th when I drove by. Most people think that they cannot move their car because it will somehow hurt their relationship with their insurance company. And we've even had incidents where our Comet, the folks from ODOT that come out to deal with these, try to facilitate improvement on these sort of issues. Well, they will argue with the Comet person. They will even argue with police officers and say, "No, we can't move our car because it's not allowed," or we'll somehow lose our insurance benefits. And that's just not true, and this follows, really we're taking it from a Georgia law that requires people to move it off the road. If they can physically do that, it'll allow a Comet truck to push them off the road so that we can get the lanes going again. Again, reduce the economic negative economic impact. State of Washington has it. If they can move it, we're saying with Senate Bill 566 that they must move it.
Thank you. My name is Bill Close. I manage the Traffic Signal and Street Lighting Division and Intelligent Transportation Systems for the City of Portland. And Chair Metzger and Senators, thank you for allowing us to speak today. One thing I wanted to add on that was kind of interesting. You know, I've worked for the City of Portland for nearly 25 years, and this is the first time I ever had a voicemail from a commissioner on that Monday morning, like, hey, what's going on? You know, sort of thing. So Sam has put a lot of energy into this, and it's been very positive because, as shown here, there were a lot of things we can do. One thing he didn't say, he thought, gee, this incident must be ODOT's problem. You know, I'll just go beat up an ODOT. Well, one of the big issues is actually the tow contract is administered by City of Portland. Mm-hmm. So part of the issue in this crash, the tow truck's supposed to arrive in 20 minutes, but as we showed there, it was 45 minutes or whatever it was, 55 minutes. And so a lot of that delay was the fact that maybe they didn't. So Sam said, I guess maybe we're in this too.
Yep.
So as we looked at that, one of the easiest things, a lot of these crashes are non-injury, so a high potential. And what happens when those occur and there is non-injury, they call 911. There's no police officer dispatched. There's no fire truck dispatched. They do call ODOT, which has the Freeway Service Patrol, we call Comet, and those are the one-ton pickup things, and they're really out there just to try to get the cars moving again. Their job is to, whatever they can do to help. They give a gallon of gas. They inflate tires. They get thousands of cards a year from people like, wow, that was a really, it is a great service, and that is what they would like to do. So what we're trying to do is we still want that to that, but we want some strengthen in some other areas that need work. So if we talk about 566 first, and actually part of this, the Post Committee also has people from private industry and the trucking community who have been very supportive for doing these things. Some of you, I don't think anybody's as old as I am, but we were always taught that, you know, we have the crash, we better stop and wait for the police, we can't move any. He looks pretty young to me. We can't. that we can't move the vehicle. It would be a major.
Number one, never piss off the chair.
That's a City of Portland term.
So, what we're saying, you know, it's cops aren't coming. You need to get out of the way. And just as you said, some of the drivers had reported that, you know, if you're drivable, drive off. They say, no, I'm not going to. So there's about 30 states that have similar legislation, as does Washington State. And this just says, you know, if you can move it off to the shoulder, off to a safe parking place, get out of the way. The second one, 567, relates to the hours and towing. So we have the issue when we talk about vehicles on shoulders. It's kind of actually shocking when you look at the crash data on our freeways. Portland State recently looked at the past 10 years, and there were 268 crashes in those 10 years that happened with parked vehicles on the shoulders. Six people died. And there were also 102 injury accidents. So these are really serious. This is very similar, even like when officers come and, you know, we pass the bill about if an officer has a light, you need to move over and how many times they're hit. You know, it happens. So we really need to do what we can do to move these vehicles off to the side. Previous law and the law that we are amending actually said that between during the normal morning and afternoon peak hours, we could declare any vehicle on the shoulder a hazard and take it. What we were asking for now is just to extend that to the rest of the day, that if a vehicle is on the shoulder that's under 26 tons, that we could tow that vehicle. And so that's what we're looking at. Now, all these are still parts. We're still working in Portland to move ahead with these. We brought these up now because we didn't want to, you know, wait for another session of the legislature. These are fairly simple, they're low cost, and they'll be very effective. And, by the way, on the back, we have information sheets, one-pagers, but on the back of the 567, you have the Don't Cry Over Spilt Milk. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, great bills and anything that we can do to solve congestion. The number I was thinking when Commissioner Adams was testifying, I think the number one, it definitely ranks in the top three, and obviously the state has very little jurisdiction over the issues like this that we appreciate you bringing to our attention, is congestion, and then, because I think it's where the public interacts with government the most, or at least the most readily, is also in parking and parking in the city of Portland. And so anything, we ought to do this, and anything that the city can do in terms of congestion, obviously, and I know it's huge challenges with downtown, but also the parking environment and the courtesies of the folks that enforce parking violations. I was just thinking, hearing the testimony, it was one of the things that I hear more frequently than partly because my district's close to Portland.
Right, and it's an area of constant and ongoing and continuous improvement.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Sam. Well, Mr. Chair, you made me promise not to ask the commissioner about the Burnside couplets, so obviously.
That's very nice.
Any other questions? If you could stay just for a moment, go ahead and sit back. But I have one other person to sign up to testify. That's Amy Joyce on Senate Bill 567. In case there's a question, you can answer, and then we'll try to get you on the road, Commissioner.
They're talking.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation, Highway Division, handed out a little bit of written testimony. Just briefly, the department is neutral on 567. We would just note that we have a bit of a problem with what it seems to be a policy decision in the Dash 1 amendments that puts smaller passenger vehicles as essentially being more of a hazard parked next to the highways than our big rigs, where you've got that 26,000-pound difference. So current law gives quite a bit of latitude for determining what is and isn't a hazard or an obstruction by putting into statute, in effect, kind of a carve-out for big rigs. We're concerned that that may take away some of our latitude, where essentially a policy has been stated that smaller vehicles are more of a hazard than larger vehicles.
Okay. Mr. Russell, I think you better come up here. Mr. Truck. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Give us your perspective on this.
My name is Bob Russell, President of the Oregon Trucking Associations. And the discussions that I had with Commissioner Adams in the city, basically the difference between trucks and cars is that when you go to tow a big truck, you've got to get a big tow truck and you've got to close a lane, and it actually provides more of a disruption of traffic than if you send out a tire. Most often it's a flat tire or something like that. You send out a tire truck, change it beside the road, and it doesn't disrupt traffic nearly as much as towing the big truck. So that's the distinction that is made in the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. Questions for either of our guests? Okay. Quiet today. On 567, where are we? This is the towing bill. Are we okay with that? Let's close public hearing on Senate Bill 567 and 566. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 567.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 567.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 567. Further discussion on that? Any objection to that? Order.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 567 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask Janet or any of the proponents? So what is the distinction between how a small or a regular car would be treated, and then one of the trucks that Mr. Russell referred to? They're stranded on the side of the road.
But there is the ability, if it's a hazard or it's in the travel lane, to tow it at any time. These traffic hours of day just give an additional authority. In fact, because in line 9 of the, if you can see line 9 of the bill, it's current law, hazard or obstruction includes but is not necessarily limited to, these are mostly guidelines, and I think the city's looking for additional clarity that they can do it during the day, because if a truck was partly in the travel lane, they would be able to tow it or have it towed. So the trucks would still be stay under current law.
Current law.
Traffic hours and at nighttime if they're a hazard. But cars, the city would have clear authority to tow at any time.
Cars.
The cars.
And who, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
And who is the requester of the dash ones?
The city.
Request the dash ones. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Starr, I'll ask you to carry that bill. And we're not going to move 566 today. We will move it, but because it has a broad relating clause, I may need it for some of our other transportation stuff. I do want to thank Commissioner Adams as he walks out, however, to thank him because this helps relieve congestion. And you heard him on the record saying he can do it for the city of Portland without any additional money. So now that we know where we can put the money now because Portland won't need it. And so that really helps. Thank you so much.
Very generous.
Okay. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 557. Janet. Gold Star.
Okay.
It is Gold Star.
Okay, Janet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 557 would, the original bill directs the Department of Transportation to establish a Gold Star family license plate program for surviving family members of a person that is killed while on active duty in the armed forces. And you have at your place today the Dash 1 amendments that would allow the department to use an existing group plate design and to design a Gold Star decal or logo and the words Gold Star Family for a plate to affix to the plate.
Thank you. Let's ask Ed Wright and Senator Morris come forward.
For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator, District 8, Albany Corvallis. With your pleasure, Mr. Chair, I would like to have Ed Wright and Michael Thorpe and his wife, Terry, come forward.
Okay.
I'll just make some very brief remarks and then have them address the
sure.
bill.
Sure, absolutely. Have it, please.
I very, very much appreciate the work that you have done, Mr. Chair, in helping bring this bill forward, amend it, and find a way that we can craft a license plate that will, in fact, honor those members that have lost family members in conflict and make it fit within the system that we have. So your efforts are very much appreciated. And with that, I would like to have Ed Wright, my policy advisor, who has worked very closely with Michael and his wife, Terry, and this bill is brought forward at their request. So with that, Mr. Chairman,
okay,
I would like
please
to
come forward with him. Welcome.
I'm a little nervous today, guys, so bear with me. Senators and Mr. Chairman, my name is Terry Thorpe, and I'm here today to give testimony on Senate Bill 557. I'm the proud mother of Lance Corporal Tyler John Troyer, killed in action November 19th of 2005 in El Karma, Iraq. I'm here today in honor of my son and all of our fallen soldiers. I'm asking you to please consider the Gold Star plate, not just for myself, but for other Gold Star families. Today, as you can see, I'm wearing my son's class ring and his original dog's tags. I wear them as a symbol of my loss and my honor. The Gold Star plate would give me that same pride and honor. I live my life every day remembering my son, and this is a great way for us to express to our state and our communities. This plate needs to be special and unique because that is what we are. We are a group of special people that no one wants to be a part of. We have given the ultimate sacrifice, our loved ones' lives. When I see other special plates, it makes me think about what it means. Like the veterans plate, I see a lot, and it reminds me of a time when this country turned its back on our soldiers. We have changed that over the years, and it is time for this state to step up and show the Gold Star families how much their loss means to this state. Tyler gave his life for something he believed in. He watched his brothers die. He would be so proud of his state if they gave if they took the time to recognize these families and his own. Let us Gold Star families honor them by showing the state that if, even though we live every day with our loss, we are proud of our loved ones and the sacrifice they made. Please help us make this possible. Also, as you take this into account, please understand that this plate should also be free of charge to our Gold Star families. We have paid enough, the life of our loved ones. To give this plate to our Gold Star families without cost, money value, is a great honor to our fallen soldiers. Do you know if there is anyone in your neighborhood who has lost a loved one to the war? I don't. The Gold Star plate is a way for us to identify those people. There are days. There are days that I wish I knew someone in my neighborhood who felt the loss like I do. Someone to cry with, someone to laugh with about the memories of my son. Is that person down the street? I don't know. But the Gold Star plate would make it possible for us and our state to identify those people and give them the honor and the pride they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
I don't really, Senators, Mr. Chairman, I don't really have a prepared statement.
Just please identify yourself, Michael.
I am Michael Thorpe.
Thank you.
Senator Morris is presenting this bill on my behalf and behalf of my wife. I just kind of wanted to give you a little rundown on where I came up with this. After our son was killed, we were invited to North Carolina at Camp Lejeune for a memorial service for all the lost brave souls of the 2nd Marine Division. And when we went there, it was the first opportunity for us to meet other people who walk on our shoes. We'd never talked to anybody. We didn't know what it was going to be like. But when we went there, we actually met the parents of a friend of our son's who died October 6th before him. And this was somebody who knew. It was kind of weird that we had an instant connection with this particular family. And they're from Canton, Massachusetts. And you know, we really hit it off good with them, and you know, we spent 3 or 4 days together. You know, went through the ceremony, and we learned a lot about other families from other parts of this country. You know, who lost their sons, and it was after we came back here that, you know, we developed a dialogue with this particular family and several other families who were friends of our sons. And so we have a common thing together that, you know, our sons served in harm's way together. And they didn't die together, but they're all in the same place now. And so in developing this relationship, you know, with this particular family, who's and her name is Mary Cabino. Her son was Lance Corporal Shane Cabino. You know, she just kind of mentioned to me off the wall during a discussion, it's like, well, do you guys, you know, have a Gold Star license plate? And I didn't even know what that was. I knew what Gold Star was, but I didn't know. And so she gave me a web address to the RMV in the state of Massachusetts, and I went, and you'll be able to see a picture on the handout he has of the Gold Star plate done by the state of Massachusetts. But as soon as I saw that plate, it's like, you know, I didn't know if we had something like that here. I knew we had differing plates, you know, the Crater Lake and Salmon and different veterans handicap. We have a lot of different plates here. And so I went to the DMV website and looked through every plate there. I was really surprised to see we had nothing. And that's where, you know, I placed a phone call to Senator Morris in August of last year. And this is where we kind of come up with this thing. But, you know, when your loved one dies, you know, they're put away with honor. They're buried with honor. And we're presented with a flag. And I know that's something that's happened over the course of many, many wars. But what happens after that? You know, our sons are gone. Our husbands are gone. Fathers are gone. But what happens to the families? What happens after that? You know, we're forgotten. I wear this, and people read this, they know my son died. And, you know, I show them these dog tags. They know my, you know, I have these. My son is dead. And there's a lot of other families going clear back to all the previous wars. World War One, World War Two, Vietnam, Korea, you know, there's a lot of other families from this state, you know, that went through the same thing. And they buried their loved ones. And then what? And the only people that I really remember are the people who knew that particular person. But nobody else does. People come and go, people die, new people are born, and they live their lives, but nobody knows, you know, what you went through and what you sacrificed in losing your loved one. And that's where I think a license plate is a way to, for people, if they choose to do so, to express their pride in the loss of their loved ones. Because we have a license plate for everything. Hey, I went to U of O. I went to OSU. And you can look at these little stickers on the back of somebody's car as you're following them down the freeway, and it's like, yeah. You know, I want somebody to see that gold star. That's what I want to see. I'm a gold star. I'm proud. I will display it. I have things written on the back of my truck that are very graphic to who I am. And I'm proud of those things. I will always, I won't hide from them. But it's a choice. And some people, it may be too difficult for them to revisit the pain, even 30, 40, 50 years after the fact. Because if you release it, it'll never leave you, ever. But this is something that I really think that the state of Oregon needs to do for these people, so to give them that opportunity to have that recognition and be able to display this pride. And it's a small token. It really is, because there's a lot of other states that have done it, and there's a lot of states that have legislation to do it, and it's going to catch fire. And I think within the next 10 years, probably every state in this country will have something similar. And I'd really like to see the state of Oregon, you know, do the same. And, you know, I'm willing to work with anything to do fundraising or anything to get this done, because these families deserve this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thorpe. Mr. Wright, you want to add some things?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Ed Wright. I'm the policy advisor for Senator Frank Morris. Frank handed me the notice on the Gold Star plate, which I've never seen before, and did some research and contacted these good folks, and from there then we introduced the bill and have been trying to work with ODOT and others then to come up with some design for unique plate. As Michael Thorpe mentioned, it needs to be unique. It needs to stand out and be something other than just a normal group. Maybe the new plate design that's coming up through the veterans will have a means to allow this to happen without the words veteran being on it, because these folks are not veterans. But the plate needs to be distinct. We need to notice it. And as Michael mentioned, there are many other states that have started doing this. You see some of the plates that I brought forth on my testimony here. And it's a small way to honor the people who have paid the ultimate sacrifice to lose a son or daughter in a war. So listen, period. It's hard. This is really hard. And the pain and the memory doesn't go away. We have people here who have been forgotten from the Korean War and the veterans, Vietnam War, my era, World War II. All the little wars that come along. People go in harm's way, and sometimes they can meet the ultimate harm, the death. And we need to honor those folks. Any questions?
Thank you, Troy. Any questions?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank the parents. I have a son and daughter, probably this close to yours. I just feel you're so courageous being here to do this, because I think it'll mean a lot to a lot of other families also.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you. Mr. McDonald, do you want to come forward? Nancy Manage? Mina? And then we'll wrap up with Jack Evans.
Okay. I'm Nancy Mina. I come here today as president of the Willamette Valley chapter of Gold Star Wives of America, Incorporated. Our organization was federally chartered by Congress in 1945, and today is open to both husbands and wives of military members that have had a service-connected death. We come today to support the Gold Star Family License Plates. Many states provide numerous benefits for surviving members of the military. As you know, Oregon does not provide much other than the small partial property tax exemption that is offered to both veterans and widows of veterans. So it is heartening to us that Oregon might acknowledge the sacrifice made by surviving family members through this license plate. Although the service member is the one that has made the supreme sacrifice, it is the parent, the spouse, the child, the siblings, the grandparents, and with the extended ages of those serving right now, even the grandchildren that feel this tremendous loss. Today I speak as a surviving wife and as the mother of my fatherless children. We are the ones that had to pick up the pieces and carry on, raise the children, and provide for our families. Each of us in Gold Star Wives has different circumstances and fall under many different government regulations. We have Verna, whose husband was shot down in World War II. We have Judy, whose husband died slowly from the Korean equivalent of Agent Orange. We have Lois, whose husband was killed in transit in the 50s. We have Barbara, whose husband went down in the Scorpion submarine in 1968. This is still classified, so she does not even know if it was an accidental explosion or a torpedo from the Russian sub nearby. We have Mike, whose wife was shot in the early 90s in Korea. We have Betsy in the back of the room here with little Joe, whose husband was killed by an IED in Afghanistan. My husband served as a Marine officer from 1966 to 1979, and although earning his medals while serving in Vietnam, including the Silver Star, Navy and Marine Corps Medal, and Navy Commendation Medal with V, he was shot while serving in the National Guard in 1984. At that time, I was pregnant with our fifth child and had four other children, aged 10, 8, 5, and 3. Raising children today as a single parent is not an easy task, especially children that have suffered the trauma of losing a parent through a violent death. And although it is my husband that made the supreme sacrifice, it is our family, including his parents, that lives that sacrifice each and every day. Every birthday, holiday, graduation, wedding is bittersweet. We are a proud family. We are proud of his service, and although we would have preferred not to, we are proud of the service that we have made for our country. It is a sacrifice we make each and every day. Back when my husband was killed, it was an isolating event, just as it was when my mother became a military widow in 1963. Once the funeral was over, you were not supposed to speak about it. People did not want to hear about it. You were expected to go away quietly and struggle on your own to raise your family. Times and circumstances have changed. Families of the newly killed are given support in many ways from both governmental and private sectors, including adequate insurance, scholarship support groups, and many events for the children. This was a much-needed change and is greatly appreciated. Probably only those of us who have gone through this situation in the past can fully appreciate how important these changes are. As Gold Star Wives, our organization has lobbied tirelessly for these new widows. The flurry of gold hats and jackets are a common sight in the halls of Washington, D.C. We could not stand by and see these new, sometimes very young widows go through the struggles that we had to, in addition to the grief that they face. Those of us that have made this walk alone hold out our hands to lift up the ones beginning their journey today. You have no doubt heard of the Band of Brothers. We as Gold Star Wives of America, Inc. are indeed a sisterhood. The death of all service members need to be honored. Each and every member of the military knows there is a risk. Whether it is walking point, jumping out of an airplane, riding in a transport where there may be an IED along the road, or becoming drenched in Agent Orange. Although the military member may earn a medal or ribbon for his or her specific actions while serving, in death, all the family members are making the same sacrifice. One death is not any less mourned than another. A fatherless or motherless child does not suffer any less if the parent was killed by a sniper's bullet in Iraq or a helicopter crash in Oregon. We thank you for considering a license plate that will honor not only the supreme sacrifice made by the service member, but also recognize the sacrifice made each and every day by the loved ones left behind.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McDonald, you want to make some comments?
My name is Matt McDonald, and I normally represent the United Veterans of Oregon, but they have not discussed this bill. I have a couple of recommendations for this bill. One, that the plate be a permanent plate. In other words, like the Disabled Veterans Plate, XPOW Plate, and the Medal of Honor Plate. This plate, you buy it one time, and it's a lifetime plate. The second thing is, I think we can come up with a better plate than one with the pine tree on it. What I'm asking this committee is to hold an abeyance for a week and let me work with Department of Motor Vehicles to come up with a better plate. And what I have in mind is possibly using the new veterans plate that's going through the legislation now, using that plate, only underneath rather than have the word veterans have Gold Star family. It'll cost less than if we adopt a new plate. So what I'm asking for is we will discuss this on Saturday with the United Veterans of Oregon. Next week I will work with the Department of Motor Vehicles and the Department of Veterans Affairs to come up with a new plate.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. We're going to have Jack Evans come up because actually he's been working with, among others, the veterans on what is the product before us today. So any questions for these folks? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Jack?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Jack Evans from the Department of Transportation, and here to talk about the plate that will honor the Gold Star families. We've looked at a number of different concepts regarding this plate, and thanks to Senator Metzger for working with us and coming up with, challenging us to come up with a creative solution that doesn't create any new plates and that avoids the need to charge folks for the creation of a new license plate. What we're envisioning is taking an existing group plate for which there's universal eligibility and allowing the surviving family members of persons killed in active duty with the Armed Forces of the United States to receive that plate. And on it would be a decal with the 5-point gold star. The department will determine the specifications for proof of eligibility and some of the other details via administrative rule. And because we've been using an existing group plate, there's no programming costs or some of the other things that are associated with the establishment of a new group plate. A person that would receive the plate then would pay the $2.50 per year registration of the registration period, which is the surcharge for the group, and that those funds would go to that group. And for example, we've looked at the Support Our Troops plate, so it'd be a $10 fee for 2 years, and that fee would then go to the Support Our Troops organization. We, early on, in reference to the veterans plate, we've been working with the Veterans Administration over the course of the interim to come up with a group plate that subsumes all the existing veterans group plates, and there's about 11 or 12 of them. There's only two active group plates that meet the criteria of 500 or more sales or renewals per year to stay active. The rest have drifted into inactive status. This will bring all the plates under one newly designed veterans plate, not a new plate, but a newly designed plate, and it'll allow the smaller groups to meet the 500 plate criteria and essentially continue to raise funds for their organizations, etc. We had considered at one point honoring the Gold Star families with that plate by actually having the Gold Star placed on that plate. The plate design envisions a four-letter configuration and then a blank area on the left side of the plate, and that would either be left blank for any veteran, or they could include insignia of their particular branch of service or a decoration of valor or the Purple Heart, or those types of decals would be placed in that space. We thought, well, that might be an opportunity to honor the Gold Star families by placing the Gold Star in that area. However, the Veterans Administration took a look at this and spoke with some veterans. And the veterans felt that, well, it's been a time-honored tradition that these plates be eligibility for these plates be restricted to veterans and not expanded any further. So we moved away from that concept. But, that's something that we might be willing to... The veterans might be willing to revisit. We could certainly talk about that. The constraints that we're operating under, however, is to not create any situation where we're doing new programming, creating new categories of plates, and incurring those new programming costs. So those are our considerations that as we look at the various opportunities to honor these folks.
Thank you, Mr. Evans, and I want to thank you for a lot of hard work. I know you spent a lot of time on this, working with Mr. Wright and Senator Morris and others, and going back to the drawing board trying to find a way to make that work, that's really appreciated. And in our packet, we have a suggestion of what that would look like. Any questions for Mr. Evans?
Yes, just one.
Senator Morris Anderson.
How much is it to start a whole new plate again? I know you gave me those figures, but I can't remember.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, it's about $21,000 for all the costs associated with a brand new group plate.
And you say to be really sustainable, you need to be selling about 500 a year.
The statutes at this time say that you need to sell new or renew 500 plates every year. So of the 31 groups that are in existence now, only five of them are able to make that criteria. Plates are still being sold, but this is in order to purchase, in order new inventory of plates and keep the program going.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Stark.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack, for being here. A question I have, and actually Senator Deckert and I just conversed on this quietly, is the cost. In your testimony, it says a person applying for a Gold Star family plate would be required to pay a $10 surcharge. What would it take for the department to waive that fee, and what kind of fiscal impact would it be to the department if we were to waive that fee for Gold Star families?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, we'd have to take a look at that. The reason that $10 is charged is that we're using an existing group plate program. So the only difference is that we're putting a Gold Star on it. But all the other statutory requirements, the eligibility and the cost for that particular plate, the surcharge, would still be met. In order to take that $10 out and not that $10 doesn't go to the department, it goes to the, in this case, the Support Our Troops organization. Or if it were Vietnam vets, it would go to their organization to sustain their activities. So we'd have to take a look at what the impact would be on the organization and if there's some creative way we might be able to waive that.
Well, I would encourage that conversation to be continue to be held. I think I agree with Mr. McDonald that these families shouldn't have to have an added expense. I understand that the fee goes to a good organization, but we ought to figure out a way to accommodate that as well. That's at least my take on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Any other questions?
Just a clarification, because I noticed here you showed where the Gold Star would be, but I thought you were also talking about the Support Our Troops. I'm not sure what...
Senator Morris, so the yes. plate is the one, and the base plate is what would be used for Support Our Troops, and except it's been changed for the Gold Star family. But this is that comes from that issue. And then the $10 that Senator Starr mentioned goes to that organization to help support our troops.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. We'll come back to this. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 557. Thank you all for coming. And we'll continue that discussion with some of the comments today. Who is? Okay. Let's put a public hearing on Senate Bill 982. Senator Devlin, I know we'll be brief.
Chair, with the chair of the commission.
Oh, shoot. That might change the dynamic, but
is that helping cause?
Might be a good change. Welcome. Janet, would you please tell us, first of all, what this is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 982 came out of the Senate Bill 17 Task Force Review of the Telecommunications Law over the interim. It updates the definition of telecommunication services and statute related to regulation of the utilities. Mr. Chair, if you're looking at the bill, the principal change is on page 2, and the new definition of telecommunications and the new definition of telecommunication services, which is on line 17 through 20. And the new language on the bottom of page 2 is identical to the language that's on the front page being deleted. It's just moved. So,
okay. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 982 is a relatively simple bill. It came out as part of the Senate Bill 17 task force that was passed in the last legislative session that I actually believe was made up of almost 17 different members. But the co-chairs of that task force were myself and Senator Nelson, along with two members from the House that were the legislative representatives, Representative Butler and Representative Rosenbaum. The task force was charged with reviewing laws governing telecommunications. They met frequently in public meetings and engaged numerous stakeholders. They discussed numerous issues relevant to economic regulation of wireline services, service quality regulation, standardization of service quality, reviewing the structure of the Federal Universal Service Fund and the Oregon Universal Service Fund, whether or not we have a level playing field for telecommunications providers, consumer protections, broadband availability, platform convergence, and the relevant federal legislation, and how to get the state into conformance with the 1996 Telecommunication Act. Note that I said 1996 Telecommunication Act. Using a consensus approach, they brought forward only two small bills. The first one you heard a few weeks ago, and that was the redefinition or the giving the PUC Commission latitude to make adjustments relative to the Federal Universal Service Fund. The second one here is here today. This bill is relatively simple. The underlying principle of this bill is to modernize the definition of Oregon statute without expanding or contracting the regulatory authority of the PUC. The bill modernizes Oregon's definition of telecommunications service. The bill adopts federal definition of telecommunications and telecommunications service. And passage will make Oregon laws easier for industry to understand and the PUC to enforce. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you should be glad to hear this bill. I'm going to be a little bit in jest here today, because if you look at another bill that's actually in this committee, SB 936, it looks relatively familiar to a bill that is now in the House, which is an earlier version of some of the drafting of that bill, and that bill is HB 2621 in the House. That is a full-blown telecommunications bill with many of the issues that were before the SB 17 task force, and I think you should be very glad that they are discussing that bill in the House and not in your Senate committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Chairman Beyer.
I didn't get the joke, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I'd like to commend the hard work that Senator Devlin, Senator Nelson, and his two House colleagues and the other members of the stakeholders group did in spending over a year actually going very thoroughly through the bill. And they had a goal of trying to come up with a consensus documents on how to change that and bring our Oregon law into compliance with the federal law. Discussed a lot, only agreed on two things. One, as the Senator said, you passed, and the other one is in front of you now. This is a relatively complex stuff, but it's fairly simple what we're doing here. And essentially, all we're doing is bringing Oregon's definition of telecommunications in compliance with the federal definition. Why that's important is it makes it easier on all of the various businesses that have to deal with this and different things to have one definition and one set of, well, not one set of rules, but one definition. So when you're talking about it, we all know what it means. So it's simple. I don't believe there's any opposition on this bill.
Thank you, Chairman. Is there any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator George.
Thank you. Lee, I just
because I'm new to this field on this, on page 2, and it's at line 37, it says telecommunication utilities not include any plant or owned or operated by a municipality. Why is the public, why are public municipalities excluded from this bill? Why are they excluded from the definition? And when I look at it, I couldn't figure out why there's two sets of. I guess what I'm asking, why is there a policy?
Why is there a policy?
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
Policy of the legislature.
Okay. Wise at some point in the past.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just state it's like part of my earlier presentation. All we did here was basically put in statute what the current authority of the PUC is. We didn't contract it. We didn't expand it. So it basically follows every other statute that we have.
I didn't know if there was a thank you. I just didn't know if there was a policy reason for doing that.
Right. Any other questions? Close public hearing on Senate Bill 982 and open a work session on Senate Bill 982.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Beckett.
I don't want to get on.
No, I wasn't here.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I'm voting for this bill.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, look what we got going here.
Yeah.
I move Senate Bill 982 to the floor with the two-pass recommendation.
Senator Deckard has moved Senate Bill 982 to the floor with the two-pass recommendation. Further discussion? I actually held on to the bill because of a relating clause. That's the only reason we have it so late. But I have another one coming with the same relating clause. So if there's no objection.
You're making us very, very nervous.
No, all of us. We'll ask Senator Devlin to carry.
Thank you.
Yeah, the common theme today.
This marks Senator Montesano's excuse on the vote. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 1027. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1027 would establish the Hood River Waterfront Employment Project Fund for design or reconstruction and operation of one or more commercial buildings or property owned by the Port of Hood River. Would authorize issuance of $2 million in lottery bonds to fund a grant by OECDD to the fund and specify conditions that must be met for the grants to occur, including sponsors documenting that they have sufficient financing to complete the project. The bill does have an emergency clause effective July 1st, 2007. And you have at your place the -2 amendments, and these were at the request of the State Treasurer's Office to make the bonding provisions work. They make a number of changes so that there's no obligation to disperse until there's sufficient deposits in the fund. Make the authority to issue the bonds permissive instead of mandatory by the State Treasurer and clarify which agencies eligible for repayment of bond-related costs. And, Mr. Chair, deleting a provision that gives this project first available residual lottery revenues. So the court just saw these amendments in the last couple of days, but the Treasurer's Office said those were important before it goes to those names. And that's the final thing. This bill does have a subsequent refer to the Finance and Revenue and then the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Do we have our sign-up list there, Janet?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let's start with Mr. McKelvey. I know he's going to be there. Welcome.
Chair Metzger, Senators, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Michael McKelvey. I'm the Executive Director at the Port of Hood River, 720 East Port Marina Drive. I'm here on behalf of the Commission to testify in support of 1027 because we believe that in the next 3 years this can result in over $20 million worth of private investment and over 200 jobs on the Hood River waterfront. By way of background, you may know that the Hood River waterfront looks a lot today like the way it looked about 20 years ago. There's not been a lot of significant change right there that isn't directly related to recreation. However, the city of Hood River, the county of Hood River, have had significant economic development. So the waterfront's the front door to Hood River. It has significant properties that are available for development, for industrial job and employment. But it sits in an area that has is in a scenic area. It's adjacent to world-class recreation sites, and it acts as the front door to the city. So there's a lot of goals, a lot of different objectives and different visions that compete on the waterfront. At the same time, in Hood River, the land costs and housing costs have risen dramatically. And the waterfront represents a pretty specific and significant opportunity for job creation in our community. Now, the good news is that there's an opportunity, significant opportunities right now. There are local businesses that are successful, that are growing, and that are adding jobs. But this county is significantly land constrained, as you probably know. It has a lot of EFU land, it has national forest land, and it has a very limited supply of light industrial. So the waterfront represents, to the largest extent, perhaps in excess of 90% of the light industrial or employment land within the city, and probably over half within the county. So we have growing dynamic firms that need to be in Hood River that, without the proper location, may leave the county or leave the state. And we have an opportunity to concentrate employment within an industrial core along the waterfront adjacent to businesses like Hood River Distillers, and in conjunction with businesses like Dakine as their international headquarters, the Hood River Juice Company, Boeing Maritime Services, and others that are down there. The challenge to implement this and take advantage of this opportunity is really infrastructure. So we need to find a way to provide that infrastructure to get these businesses down there. A couple of them in particular have significant trucking needs, although it's adjacent to the interstate and a great location for those kinds of businesses. We need to upgrade not only the ODOT portion of the frontage road coming off of exit 63, we have to provide an internal industrial alley, and we need to upgrade the adjacent streets around it. So the challenge we face is about $5 million worth of infrastructure investments. And if I could ask someone to put the board up on the easel, I'd appreciate it. So we don't face the challenges of a normal business park. This isn't simply about providing a roadway. It's about providing access to the interstate, and it's providing the infrastructure and the armature for a business and employment opportunities that can successfully locate adjacent to literally world-class recreation sites. What you see here is a diagram, and I'd encourage you to think of it as a diagram, but this to your lower right is exit 63 off Interstate 84. Second Avenue, Second Street going northbound is a street that the port has constructed for about $700,000. The yellowish building in the upper right is the Expo Center, which is now an opportunity for the company Dakine, and we're in negotiations with them. The large building in the middle is a possible location for the Hood River Juice Company and some tremendous opportunities there. And to the left of that is the Hood River Distillers, which is a long-standing business on our waterfront, one that's growing as well. So what you see here is in gray are those primary transportation infrastructure needs. Riverside Drive, a large portion of that is owned by ODOT. That internal alley that I referred to allows us to concentrate those back-of-house loading and access issues in the industrial core. And Portway Avenue has significant improvements that are required in order to subdivide the property. So if you're in your handout, you'll see that diagram, and you'll see a rough sources and uses of funds. And obviously, this is not something that we can ask the state to pay for completely. We would come up locally with $1 million more or less from the port and $2 million more or less from the benefiting businesses. But we need that extra $2 million to make this happen. And we need state assistance to fill that gap. So we believe that with your support and the successful legislation, we would have that gap filled, and we would be able to, within the next 3 years, implement much of what you see there. As I mentioned before, we anticipate over $20 million worth of investment, private investment, and over 200 jobs on the waterfront. So it's an opportunity to transform this waterfront in a way that hasn't happened in years. One quick thing I would point out that you may ask, and rightly so, why don't you go to known or existing programs for this? OECDD has been a good partner. They have existing programs to immediate opportunity and strategic reserve that can fulfill some of these. The answers, in brief, are one, it's not enough for this need. The $2 million request that I spoke of, it's not possible to achieve that with existing programs. Second, we need a fair degree of certainty that we can have that, it'll be available, and we can get moving on this. And third, I would point out that the port of Hood River and the ports around the state are economic development arms of the state. In fact, one can argue that we have the most effective on-the-ground methods to implement what you see there. We do infrastructure, we own infrastructure, and we can literally be in the ground this fall. We don't have the luxury of going through a long extended process and having to bear that extended time frame. So for those reasons, I would suggest that this is a good opportunity for the state to participate as a partner with the port and community of Hood River. Thank you very much.
McKelley. Let's go to Mr. Fashing and then Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Fashing. I'm the Economic Development Coordinator for Hood River County. I'll just try to hit on a few things that maybe Michael didn't really hit. But this investment would help break a 20-year logjam on the waterfront. The public investment will be leveraged by the private sector investment, which Michael mentioned. Currently in Hood River County, we have an extreme shortage of industrial lands, and the infrastructure improvements needed on this property will help us to make them usable and get some private investment going on those sites for the first time in quite a few years. Hood River County, as you've probably heard me say every time I'm here, I think I say this, we're among the lowest paid counties, average wage in the state. We're second lowest. We have been for years, despite our very affluent and progressive feel when you walk into town. Wages aren't keeping up with that, and I think this is the type of investment that will finally get us moving up in those rankings just a little bit, and really moving forward. Firms like David's, who you'll hear from in a minute, and DeKine, are paying well above the average wage in the county, and those are the types of firms we really need to be helping. In addition to the firms we're working with on right now on the waterfront site, there are a number of other existing firms that we're working with that are looking at expansion opportunities either on this parcel somewhere or elsewhere in the county, we're hoping. If all goes well, this site could be full in, as Michael said, 3 or 4 years. And we're going to be struggling to figure out where to put them next. As we've been talking about this project, we've started talking about the airport area as that possibly being our next best bet once this is filled up, hopefully in the next few years. And Michael and the county and the port have talked briefly about it, and if it were possible for you all to consider another amendment, is maybe a little flexibility as far as the use of these funds on other port properties, including the airport property, if we have the opportunity to move forward with one of the major firms we're working with on the ports or on port property at the airport right now to maybe help with infrastructure at that site as well, if it works out. But obviously the focus is on the waterfront property with maybe a little flexibility down the road to do something at the airport if it works out. And that's what I get for leaving my notes. I lost my place. But anyway, my additional request is to just add a little flexibility. It's not adding to the bottom line dollar request, and we'll stand with that and take that money as far as we can and leverage it as far as we can with additional private and public, local public money. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Fashing. And just for your information, this bill goes to the Committee on Finance and Revenue, chaired by the good senator from Beaverton, Senator Deckard, before it goes to Ways and Means. So it has a little journey. So what, as we consider the amendments, we'll probably ask to consider those as Senator Deckard considers this in light of his other bills that he will have on economic development in his committee, so we can get it moving for you.
That would be wonderful.
Mr. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Ryan. I am the president of Hood River Juice Company. And I personally want to thank you for your support for the Northwest Food Processors Association. I am a member of that. And also, Mr. Metzger, thank you for your support in remembering me. You wrote me a letter last summer in congratulating me on the ability to turn the company around. We are in the process.
It's got juice now. It's got juice now.
That's company. Right. Yeah. I wanted to let you know where we're at as a company. We've been growing very rapidly. We had the opportunity to purchase 6 acres on the waterfront. And prior to that, a year ago, I didn't know where we were going. But we've had the blessings of being able to bring on the two largest beverage companies in the United States. They are focused on, we have contract with one of them right now for over 8 million gallons of juice. And we're looking for areas in the fastest way that we can possibly produce it. We want to stay in Oregon. We love Oregon. And we are giving, obviously, even with our membership with the Food Processors Association, we're taking some of the business away from Washington and Idaho. But we're bringing the jobs here. And we've been able to take extremely low-paying agricultural waste jobs and raise them up. You'll notice the number that is on ours of $27,000 a year. That is without supervisor or management staff whatsoever. Last year, we implemented a program in which we were able to provide a full benefit program to our employees, and we're continuing that with also the ability of being able to triple our volume. And we know that we can't sustain that growth curve, but we're going to do everything that we can to succeed and make it happen.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Questions for our panel? Thank you very much. And our final witness is Ann Hannes from OECDD. She's going to tell us how excited she is about this project. Is that called meeting the witness? Hi.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes, acting manager of the Community Development Division for Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am very excited about infrastructure. We are very supportive of that. In fact, I believe that Oregon's future economic competitiveness is directly related to our ability to fund infrastructure adequately in the form of roads, water, sewer systems, energy communication systems, and a variety of other facilities. We fund, on the average, make awards about $54 million in loans and grants, primarily loans, to municipalities, ports, tribes, and special districts. And we do that for the purpose of helping to lead to job creation and retention, as well as we support projects that help with safety and compliance, as well as essential community facilities. Strategically, the funds that the state has are aimed at furthering economic development. And I believe we've been seeing a number of very good ideas that have been put forth recently in at least 7 bills to this session, and they total about $105 million for specific legislatively directed requests. And these requests are either for direct grants or no-interest loans. I would like to point out that they're not included in the governor's recommended budget. The demands for infrastructure funding, without a doubt, are pressing and great throughout the state. There are individual requests
for these legislatively directed funding that really underscore the need for critical funding throughout the state. I think each request in the bills, though, taken separately, have significant merit. As you can see with the Hood River project, this one would be very beneficial to the area. If we look, though, at an overall state policy and funding perspective, I think we need to consider the cumulative impact of the bills on the future funding of local government infrastructure projects and on sustaining our revolving infrastructure funds over the long term. And we need to look at whether individual projects will be fair and equitable for Oregon communities and whether they're consistent with statutory direction for making infrastructure awards. We're very eager to partner with communities, ports, tribes, and special districts around the states and work with them to assist with their financing needs through the infrastructure funds, the Oregon Bond Bank, the Immediate Opportunity Fund. And furthermore, if we see Connect Oregon being adopted by the legislature, that will too be an important source of funding. Recognizing all the needs that we have around the state, the governor has asked for a $100 million recapitalization of our infrastructure funds, and that will be so that we don't have to reduce the funding available to municipalities around the state for public infrastructure. Under the co-chair's budget, unfortunately, that request was not included. And if we don't have that request, we'll be having to reduce our infrastructure funding by around half beginning in July. I do want to note that the governor strongly supports funding for Connect Oregon 2, which will provide grants for multimodal and public transportation projects around the state. These types of infrastructure projects have been absolutely essential as we have worked to attract businesses from around the country to Oregon, Lowe's, Genentech, Pepsi, and others. So with that, I wanted to go on record regarding kind of the overall view with lottery-funded projects. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hannison. I just will point out at least the claims by the Department of 150 jobs for each $1 million, and the claim by the waterfront project at Hood River is 250 jobs, so I kind of like that ratio even better. Thank you for your comments, and I think one of the great things about these projects that help build economic development is that, you know, we vent them. We always have to put everything side by side with other opportunities in which the state can use its limited resources. And I know Senator Deckert does a tremendous job in finance and revenue trying to match those up.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important part. I can't go without saying that you mentioned a few things that aren't in the governor's budget. And as we all know, the governor's budget has a few hundred million dollars more in assumed taxes that don't exist, and so the co-chairs, I think, have done a very good job of actually having a budget that matches the revenue the state currently has. And we're certainly going to try to provide more opportunity for these types of partnerships. I know the folks at Hood River work very, very hard on that, and unlike the the pig and the poke type of approach, they've got real companies there that are not speculation, but starting to build or expand right now. And so I'm sure Senator Deckert will look at that with all the others, limited things we can do. Your admonishment, though, is valuable and is important, and we recognize the fact that there's a lot of competition for what we have. And
mm-hmm.
hopefully we'll get Connect Oregon through as well, so we can provide that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
What I'm going to do, if it pleases the committee, this has to go on to two committees. It has to go on to finance and revenue. We have a dash to amendment, but trying to save trees would mean another printing of the bill, and then Senator Deckert and company may want to make other changes. So rather than slow it up, what I would ask, we'll go to work session and just send the bill to finance and revenue. You'll have the dash two with you, Senator Deckert, to consider the treasurers as you consider the merits of the bill. And if that's okay, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1027.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 1027 to the Committee on Finance and Revenue.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 1027 be advanced to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. Any discussion? Any objection? Sorry. Thank you, and thank you all very much. And Senator Deckert will work on this next. Okay. Now, we're going to open up an informational hearing on proposed federal regulations on Real ID. I've asked Laurie Youngs, who's been very patient, hiding behind the Hood River Waterfront Project. There she comes. Thank you, Mr. Fashing. Have a safe trip back home. Colleagues, if you recall, we had a public hearing on Real ID a while back. This was before the federal proposed rules were out. And as we're moving closer to session, I thought it would be valuable for the committee, now that the department has had a chance to look at the proposed rules, their take on those, what assumptions were made in the original Real ID bill, which is in this committee and also in the House, what may have changed from the assumptions in the bill based on the rules, and also some comments, Ms. Youngs, is what you feel is based on these rules, what we need to do in order to get an extension that has been part of the rules. I think the committee would like to know kind of what your view is on that and what it would take to do that.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, hold it. Hey, you can't leave. Come back in here. I mean, a guy sneaks in, and then throughout in TV land, I'd like you to know that one of the premier senators ever to serve in the state of Oregon, in fact, he's been around so long he served in Idaho, I don't know how many states, Senator Vern Duncan is in the back of the room with guests who, I know this is going to be hard to believe, colleagues, but these people actually paid money. I believe at a church auction to spend the day with Senator Duncan. I said, I told him, I hope he didn't pay a lot for this. But he has been with his guest in the Capitol all day long. And we really appreciate seeing you, Senator Duncan, and hope that your guest just had a great day in the Capitol. It's always great to see you here.
You always put on a good show.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, sorry for the interruption. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Lorna Young. I'm the administrator of the DMV. And what I've provided for you today is a brief overview of what the key requirements of the Real ID Act that have been clarified or perhaps not clarified by the regulations, because the regulations, I would like to point out, are draft and ask for a lot of comment, ask for suggestions for improvement, and admit in some areas that they haven't solved the problem and solicit good ideas from the states on how best to resolve the problems. But in a nutshell, what they have provided for us, they were released March 1st, but officially published on March 9th, so we've got that starts the 60-day clock of comment. And the regulations once again reiterate the fact that states must be in compliance by May 8th of 2008, or their driver license or ID cards may not be accepted for federal purposes. They do clarify that federal purposes may keep a scope narrow to what was originally written in the statute, in that for such as getting on board an airplane or accessing federal facilities where a picture identification is currently required, so they're not broadening it to require it in further places. However, they do provide for an extension, and what I have provided for you in the back page of the testimony is a timeline that lets you see that we are October 1st of 2007. States who wish to have an extension is allowed until December 31st of 2009. On October 1st, you must request that extension from the Department of Homeland Security. And the language for requesting the extension is rather brief. It's the last section of the regulations. And so essentially, they're admitting that they were late in promulgating the regulations, and they expect most states will ask for the extension. And then you have approximately 6 months from the granting of that extension. And we assume that there will be a rather rapid turnaround of that granting. They say that they expect about 30 to 45 days for that. So we put on our timeline approximately April 2008. The state would have to submit to Department of Homeland Security our plan for how we would get into compliance with the regulations by the end of the extension period, which is January 31st, 2009. If you apply for the extension and granted the extension, then your state's driver licenses continue to be accepted for all federal identification purposes. Once again, the May 11, 2008 deadline is for those states that don't apply for the extension. They have to be in compliance by May 8, 2011, or they are not in compliance, and we'll see what the federal government does about that.
And January 1st is the date in which we would be, if we were to be in compliance and our compliance plan accepted by Department of Homeland Security, January 1st is the date in which we begin to issue Real ID Act compliant cards if the state chose to move in that direction. The Department of Homeland Security has decided on a 5-year re-enrollment period. They want to make sure that states that have a longer expiration date, such as the state of Oregon, which has an 8-year driver license, that we expeditiously move all of our population through the process. And so this 5-year re-enrollment period does not start at the beginning of the extension. It starts at the beginning of the compliance date. So the 5-year enrollment starts in 2008 and ends in 2013. So under their proposed rules, they would expect all Oregonians who have a driver license or ID card to re-enroll by 2013. Since Oregon is not in a position to be in compliance by 2008 because there are so many system changes that need to be put in place, we would assume that if the decision of this body is to move forward towards compliance, at a minimum we would be applying for that extension. And then we would need to re-enroll all of Oregonians in a 3-year, 4-month period. What the rules do clarify in terms of, as you recall from our earlier testimony, the bill does require that all identity documents be verified electronically with their source. And we had pointed out that there were only two systems in place right now, one for Social Security cards and one for immigration cards. The rules acknowledge that and therefore require only those two at this point. They make some reference to the birth certificate certification system, which is still in a pilot phase. They believe they declare under their temporary rule, the front part of it is a long and discussion of the intent, that system would be in place by 2008, but it's highly unlikely because they have not received full funding. So they expect that states would have either develop their own mechanism or simply note on the record that the birth certificate has not been certified, and that when that system became in place, you would then certify that birth certificate. Similar for other documents that would be required. The rules spell out that when you reapply for a reissuance of card, that you would be expected to re-verify the source documents. So we'll be imaging source documents, keeping those source documents on record, and the rules expect us to re-verify that. And the reason that the rules state for that is there may be some change in your status that would require you to be re-verifying. We are allowed to establish a written process for providing exceptions for individuals who have some situation beyond their control, cannot provide birth certificates or other documents. But there is not an exact, so there's an exceptions process for identity, but not an exceptions process for legal presence. So that's one of the areas I'm sure we will be commenting on. The process that we would put in place must be part of our compliance plan. Essentially, in order to be in compliance, it's not a question of, as we stated in our earlier testimony on the original bill, compliance means that you have enabling legislation, but also that you have a plan that you present to the Department of Homeland Security, which they review and then certify that you are in compliance. As I said, the rules now delineate the source of documents for proof of identity, and that only one of them is required, things such as birth certificates, passports, et cetera. There's a list of about 8 or so documents that would be acceptable. The states must provide electronic access to information contained in the state's database to each other. That's clear in the rules. They reiterate in the rules that a photo of the applicant must be taken prior to issuance of the card, even if they are not issued a card. And that is to deal with cases of suspected fraud. our approach to that would be to take a look at, are you an what makes you an applicant? And that's probably one of the areas that we would comment on, that an individual really wouldn't be an applicant until he had all the documents, whether they were valid or not. But that's an area that we'll need to work
Mr.
on.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
So this wouldn't require necessarily photographing everybody that walked into the DMV office.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, well, we feel that would not be a productive use of our resources, and so part of our plan would be to define the applicant as someone who at least has the minimum standards to be considered for driver license or ID card.
Thank you.
They also have a requirement that prior to issuing a card, you check with all other states to make sure that there haven't been a card already issued by that state. Which at this point is not possible, and they recognize that, but they expect that at some point there will be a system in place that will allow you to do so. Then the states must prepare a comprehensive plan for security for not only their offices and card storage, but require security. There's an extensive requirement for security features on the cards. They want the cards to be tested by an independent tester on an annual basis. And conduct an annual review of the card design to determine whether or not it's tamper-proof and can compromised. AMBA specifications for cards are what they are proposing: reformatting the card, a smaller photo, a mandatory vertical format for under 21. Currently, we have a horizontal format for individuals under 21, but we put the picture on the opposite side and we note on it that they are under 21 or under 18.
Ms. Jones, I got a question on that, on the cards. So, as you know, the last legislature we invested in the biometrics bill, changing our cards, trying to help in the issue of identity theft, entered into a contract with Digimark. How does that current contract and the money we're investing in that parallel or deviate? And I guess, or do we have to replicate those costs? We're going to have to eat some additional costs because that work is not consistent, or is it consistent with this in terms of the cards themselves?
Mr. Chair, the biometric bill will be an additional cost to any compliance cost for Real ID Act because it takes a different approach. The Real ID Act approaches identity theft prevention by verification of documents and their authenticity. The biometric approach is to verify you by a unique characteristic that you have. And so they complement each other, but they're two different approaches. It may be possible for us to use the fact that we have biometrics as one way of saying, rather than re-examine documents on the when you renew your license, we'll use facial recognition as our plan. But it's a separate track. Card specifications, as I've pointed out, changes to the 2D barcode. They have not gone with one of those smart cards or one of those embedded chips that can be read at a distance. They're looking simply at a 2D barcode with 125 character format for full legal name and name history. And they're looking for inventory control numbers on the cards, etc. They're spelling out a background check, which was in the statute for employees. And in this case, the state needs to identify any employee who affects the recording of any information required to be verified or who are involved in the manufacture or production of the card. So we would have to determine exactly how far that would stretch beyond our counter staff, including how many headquarters staff might be involved in that.
Okay. Senator Moss,
just a clarification. I think I'm getting confused regarding passport versus driver's license. And when you're talking about this code, I just renewed my passport this month. And it'll probably take me a couple months before I get it, maybe 6 months. But what I'm confused when you're talking about this and the passport.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the 2D barcode already exists on your driver license. If you flip over to the back of it, you'll see there is a 2D barcode on it. It's not used very often, but there are bars that have that barcode reader. They've been in place for quite a number of years. And in that 2D barcode is contained all the information on the front of the card except for your photograph. The concept of the barcode and a standardized format for the barcode is so that law enforcement and other entities who want to electronically swipe the card and get that information to verify that what's on the front and what's on the back match so that you haven't got a false card. That's the purpose of the barcode. There are also barcodes, codes on passports that do that for a similar purpose.
Thank you.
There's a requirement for a person's full legal name. And that requires recording of up to 125 characters, which currently our databases don't have a field that wide. And that is an area where not even federal databases all have the same name for individuals. So that's another area that we need some work on.
Can I ask a question about that? Because that one I kind of flagged as a potential real problem. I mean, well, you got married people, right? If their source documents don't have it, I've got a nephew who just moved from Salem to Tennessee with Verizon and got a new job and changed his name when he was 10 or something to have his dad's name. And but all the documents, his Social Security card, which is all different, and he had a real problem. Well, they didn't take our driver's license in Tennessee. He had to they didn't accept it anyway. They made him go through the whole new thing of proving who he was. But it was a real problem, so he ended up getting the driver's license and the other name that isn't his name, just because it was such a hassle to, I mean, he could prove who he was when he was five, but he couldn't really prove that was him now. And so, and I imagine there's probably a lot of people who would have that kind of an issue. I know you guys have talked about that as people would come to the DMV with these different changes, and the source documents that would be required may very well be documents that predate other changes in the name. And could you talk about that at all, about how that might be resolved?
Mr. Chair, that is a concern for us. Currently, and the most common name change, of course, is upon marriage. Currently, what we do is we view the marriage certificate in order to officially change the name, and then we change the name in the record. And we keep in the record the old name as part of your history and the new name. What the rules appear to require of us is that we must maintain a whole history of that name change, the documents that created the name change, and somehow keep that history in our database in a more extensive fashion than we currently do, even in perhaps a more extensive fashion than the federal government does, because I don't know that they require you to submit your birth certificate when you're submitting for a passport, your marriage certificate when you're submitting your driver license and your birth certificate, and they have different names. So they are contemplating a more rigorous process there than they currently even have for passports. It does allow us to, it does require that we have digital images of identity source documents and that they be formatted in a format that is exchangeable between states. The rules are not clear about the requirement of exchange between states. And it also states that we may renew or replace a Real ID compliant license using a previous photo on file as long as the person has a Real ID compliant card. However, Senate Bill 640 won't allow that because that our own statute requires that any time you come and get a driver license or renewal, you must come in person and get your photo taken, and we compare it with the template on file. It does, state that states can issue their own non-compliant cards as long as they clearly state on the face of them that they are not Real ID compliant. I've provided for you a high-level cost estimate over the next 3 biennia.
Oh, you're sure now, first of all, that this is high level? I mean, it's high. But
it's high.
But as long as
it's
the highest?
High level. In the sense that it is our best estimate in a short period of time with our in-house experts, but once you start diving into significant changes to information technology systems, it's like remodeling an old house. You always discover something new. So don't hold me to this being the absolute number for compliance with the rules as proposed today.
Right.
There well may be changes to what is being proposed. I anticipate there will be some changes. But one of the things I'd like to point out to you is that you see the significant impacts of that truncated re-enrollment period. By requiring us to essentially re-enroll everyone in 3 years and 4 months, we're adding $23 million to the cost of this bill. And then you see also the position impact. Then also, just to let you get a sense for how much additional cost per card it is, we simply took the forecast of the number of cards we would be issuing in the period between January 1, 2010, and essentially June of 2013, the end of the re-enrollment period, divided that by this projected cost, and that gives you approximately $16 a card more if you were to use a fee increase as a way of paying for it.
Well, that's what I'd like to ask you.
What is it?
And for just the people at home who haven't seen the page, the total real ID cost estimate, the high level cost you were talking about, was a little over $65 million.
Correct.
And the breakdown you were telling us was card. To be secure, I think we're going to have to figure it's going to be more than that, because usually things like that are, so in planning. So in your discussions within the department, are you anticipating that the best way, that's a significant amount of money, and as you know, we try to raise money for transportation, and it's very difficult in any way, much less something like this or greater. Do you anticipate this being borne then, like a passport, by the people who do receive the new ID, that they essentially pay for that cost with an increased cost for their first real ID card as a fee that would then pay back all these upfront costs?
Mr. Chair, we anticipate that is a policy decision for the legislature.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I think that's probably what's going to happen, if it happens.
Could you remind those of us that haven't renewed the driver's license recently what the current cost is to mm-hmm. renew your driver's license?
Originals are $54. Renewal, I believe, is, I want to say $31.
Pretty cheap.
No, I'm sorry. A replacement's 21, renewal's 30. I can get that figure for you, but it's in the $20 to $30 range.
And that's on the 8-year cycle.
For 8 years, correct.
Yeah, that is, as we have talked about before, that is one of the huge issues that we all have is the fact that our good federal partners haven't really ponied up the money for this, and we're asked to do that, and not even then, you can't even know for sure, for very good reasons, just exactly how much that total cost may be. And it is a substantial cost. I appreciate this overview. I'm going to ask for questions from the committee, but here's one of the key ones that I'd like to ask you, and that is, we're further down the line than was when we had the hearing on this issue a while back, and that we at least have draft rules, and time is moving on for comment and to complete those draft rules. And what you have outlined here is a tremendous workload, just technically, computer-wise, and making the systems. For whatever the policy is, and if the final rules or what the state does and doesn't do, the system to accommodate that policy decision is pretty significant.
Correct.
And I'd be curious from your expertise in working with the department as to what you feel, because there's a lot of controversy around this federal act, as you know, what you feel is the absolute critical parts that you need to do, regardless of policy decisions, but to be able to implement time-wise, because you can't make all these changes overnight. Have you given some thought to that? And if you were to have a green light to start doing some of the systems mm-hmm. development, what kind of time frame? What are the absolute essential things that you need to do in order to ask for this extension?
Mr. Chair, we certainly have given thought to that. We understand the difficulty of the policy decision and the fact that the rules are not final. At a minimum, the department would need some sort of direction from the legislature to continue to make progress on this. We worked on this, all have been working on this all during the interim, under without really any policy direction to do so, but no policy direction not to do so. So we have used our base budget to plan and to implement those things that we had the authority to implement. Given the controversial nature of this bill, I think it would be important for us to get clear direction from the legislative body about the fact that you want to work on some portion of this, at least to continue to make progress towards compliance in terms of making system changes or planning or whatever you felt appropriate. So that's one of the things that we would need, is some sort of clear direction that you want us to continue working, want us to apply for the extension. And then we would take a look at what kind of resources we might need in terms of whether you're looking at what you would need for the biennium or whether you're contemplating visiting this in the 08 session. So, but at a minimum, as we stated before, given the magnitude of the work that is before us, if we halt progress or halt work entirely, it's highly unlikely that we would be able to make an 09 deadline. And I don't know whether or not they would extend that. They're proposing to extend that, but that's a possibility.
Since we are in the comment period, and we have a request for a deadline in October, by October 2007, correct?
Correct.
And but we don't know what the final rules are going to be, and of course this legislature will be out before the end of June. Yes, we will. Do you have any, as you talk to the folks back east, any idea of when the rules will be final? What kind of a time frame, or we'll actually know what the playground is going to be for this?
Mr. Chair, they've talked in terms of being able to have the final rules this fall.
Yeah. Fall, which is also the same time you have to ask for an extension.
But prior to October.
Yeah, yeah. Because one of the things is, as you know, with Senate Bill 640 and its companion in the House, you know, there is, as you mentioned, a few changes already. And there is some specificity and some of which has been mutated a little bit by the proposed rules. And you know, one thing we have a real problem with is, with the session where the rules are, is don't want to give you the kind of specific language that may end up being negated by the rules and, when we're not in session to mm-hmm. change what you need to do based on whatever the final comments are, final rules. So that's one of the issues we have to wrestle with, and that's why I asked you about in terms of just, you know, what you thought was the minimum necessary to ask for the extension. Since while we have a clearer picture, it's mm-hmm. not a final picture in order for us to make the ultimate policy decision as to what the feds have said is the, you know, is the final word on this.
Mm-hmm.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stark.
There's no issues, though, for the department to do what you've listed kind of in point number one as it relates to Social Security verification and evidence of legal presence or lawful presence. Those capabilities are readily available. The department could implement that portion of the Real ID relatively easily with the direction from the legislature to do so, correct?
Mr. Chair, we're currently already hooked up with the Social Security Administration and are verifying the Social Security numbers for commercial drivers. We are not yet connected with the Department of Homeland Security. The question would be, if you were to hook up with the Department of Homeland Security and verify what person's legal status, what would you do with the information if it wasn't a requirement for issuance? So part of what we would have to wrestle with is, we can prepare things, but then what do you want us to do with them? Put them in essentially storage and turn them on at some point, or actually implement them?
Well, the question, Mr. Chair, is if the legislature directed the department
mm-hmm.
to do basically Social Security verification, and you wouldn't be able to issue a driver's license without lawful presence. Apparently those two databases are available to the department.
Correct.
To go right now.
Correct.
From your perspective, all you need is green light legislative authority to implement those two pieces of the initial piece of the Real ID.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. That is very, very helpful. Okay, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.